From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll speak with arts advocates about the work they're doing to increase state funding for the arts. Then, we'll speak with the chief education officer for the White House Historical Association.
People just assume because it's the White House that everything has always been minutely documented about absolutely everything that's ever happened in the White House. That is not the case.
Plus, we'll learn about an exhibit at the Maritime Museum that helps people learn where the fish they eat comes from.
The theme of the exhibit is to, so the fishing families that are very involved in the industry, and to see all the people that are bringing us the fish that we eat, you know, behind the scenes, but that create kind of a work family, if you will.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. Governor Tony Evers' most recent biennial budget address proposed several arts-related items, including increased funding for the Arts Board, one-time funding for a new Rural Wisconsin Creative Economy Grant program, and items related to film production and tax incentives. However, there is some ground to cover between proposals and concrete approved funding. Last month, people from across the state came together for Create Wisconsin Day at the state capitol, including Imagine MKE Executive Director Christine Honacki and Randy Cohen, Vice President of Research at Americans for the Arts and keynote speaker for Create Wisconsin Day. Honacki and Cohen join me to share what conversations they had with our legislators to improve the Wisconsin arts sector, and Honacki begins by explaining the key objectives of their Create Wisconsin Day visit.
There's really three things, three initiatives that we are advocating for. One is to raise the per capita spending for arts and culture in the creative sector. That's to support the Wisconsin Arts Board. And then secondly, to establishing a film office and film incentives. Right now, we are just one in four states that don't have a film office and one in 13 that don't have film incentives. We're missing out on a huge economic impact with that opportunity. And it also, of course, with the creatives in the community providing work. It's $670,000 a day, according to the Motion Picture Association, just for a small budget film. That would be the economic impact for a community. And a big film, $1.2 million. You think about Top Chef that was recently here in Wisconsin. It was $5 million alone generated just in hotel rooms. So we were advocating for that and then to fund a rural Wisconsin creative economy grant program. Because we really believe when we're flourishing in the arts and creative industries across the state, it's good for Milwaukee too.
Absolutely. So, yeah. Randy, as a keynote speaker, obviously you hit upon a lot of points and you have a bit more of a national perspective. So we are almost all the time either dead last or close to dead last in arts funding in the nation. So what's your unique perspective about coming to Wisconsin and having some of these discussions?
Yeah. So yesterday was a very exciting day in Madison and brought together 150 people from across the state, top to bottom, east to west. So the state was really well represented. And I would say by people who work in the arts and advocates for the arts and volunteer for the arts, but not just in the big cities, but in small rural communities and in suburban areas. And so there was a great energy. And it was to get people together, to get up there, meet with their legislators and help them understand the benefits of a vibrant arts community and a vibrant arts across the state of Wisconsin. Wisconsin's absolutely a great state for the arts and the cultural opportunities. Everybody loves the arts, right? They inspire us and they beautify our communities. And they bring us joy. But the fact is, they do a lot more than that. You know, people appreciate the arts as a wonderful community amenities, and they are. But the fact is, they're also businesses. And that's a story that we wanted to tell as well. And so we really encourage people to think about the arts and talk about the arts as an industry, one that supports jobs and generates government revenue. And I can tell you right here in Milwaukee, just the nonprofit arts industry, you know, so our theaters, our museums, our festivals, arts education organizations, a $334.6 million industry. That supports 4,552 jobs right here in Milwaukee and generates $57.8 million in revenue to government. So the arts are more than just a nice to have. They're necessary.
With this necessity and our current status and how long we've been last in arts funding, despite the benefits and also the monetary benefits that it can do for a region or throughout the state, what response do legislators and, you know, change makers at the Capitol, what do they have to remaining in this last or near to last place consistently?
Yeah, well, I went to see several legislators. I got in front of a senator yesterday, and we were in rooms of maybe four to up to 15 of us at one time, really all telling the stories about why it's important. The thing with the arts and why it's sometimes difficult to change perceptions is because they affect so many other areas, education, well-being, mental health. So I was sitting there listening to people who I was meeting for the first time in the room tell their stories about how the arts saved their lives, about how they came out of their shell and wouldn't be the person that they did today. I had a young girl that really started talking about, what if there were no arts, no movies, no film, no music, no song. No, she went on and on. In the room, you could feel it get somber. But what overlays with that is what Randy shared, which is the economic impact, which is what they want to hear when they need to hear the full picture of it. But it, when it comes back to population in our state, population in our city, the economic impact and how it grows industries and builds economy, that's what they want to hear.
Right. And often over history, when things get tough, when money needs to be cut, arts programs are always the first to go, right? And you kind of hit upon the point that you need to hit that fiscal argument. There's the quote-unquote the soft validation of like what we personally experience when we go to the arts and participate. But let's talk about Milwaukee specifically and your work with Imagine MKE, Christine. Can you share some specifics about the Milwaukee area? Like, say, for example, if I go see a show, what's everything around me doing that action, you know, affecting?
Yeah, so the arts have the what I call the multiplier effect. And so they're really driving the economy. So when you are going to see a show, you're not just buying the ticket to the show. You are also going to dinner or having a drink. You're getting transportation. You may be hiring a babysitter. You're going out after. You're contributing to the economy. Financially, that equates to over $31 per person in additional spend that's over and above a ticket price that you're going to see a show or program. So it's significant. Randy mentioned the bigger number impact of $334.6 million, and we are a legit sector and a legit industry. It's a business, and that's the you know, really, when we're in Madison, we're really trying to explain that. It's really getting people to understand, but we can't do it alone. Imagine MKE is here to advocate and support, but also bring people along with us so they understand. They need to reach out to their legislators where they live, tell them what's important to them. They need to vote. It's about voting as well, but they need to tell them what's important to them when they are voting. So all of that's important, and that's one of the things. That's just one of the things that Imagine MKE is doing. So it's advocacy, amplification, and advancement of our arts and culture and creative industries.
The audience spending, you know, every time we go out to an arts event, you heard Christine talk about it, is really a major value add to the community. What's interesting is 39% of attendees come from outside Milwaukee County. They averaged $37.76 per person per event. When we asked those non-local attendees, why are you here? 92% said, we came to Milwaukee specifically for this arts event. So if you're a local business, you're a restaurateur, you have a parking garage, or you do retail, or the lodging industry, you love the arts because it's bringing people to the community, and those people are spending locally.
And with this local arts economy, like there are positives and negatives, right? And Christine, if you can talk a bit about your efforts in this kind of ecosystem, if we want to call that. You're well familiar with the previous Wisconsin Policy Forum report called Curtain Time. I spoke with Rob Hankin about it as well, and I'll link that for our listeners in the web article to come. But the details that we're at is like, we need to find a solution. We can't keep operating with the way we are with the way arts funding is distributed. You know, we're reaching a point where things need to change or it's not going to be sustainable. So can you talk about any progress being made towards this goal of bringing arts organizations together, working together, trying to find different solutions, especially when it comes to funding? Because ultimately, that's the commonality between any company, large or small, is like, where are we getting our funding?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is not a new conversation. Even before the Curtain Time report came out, this you know, had been
decades-long conversation.
Decades-long conversation. And we have such a generous philanthropic community, but we really lack the public funding. We just shared that 18 cents. That's not going to do it. That's not just for Milwaukee, but that's for the entire state. So we need to have a new funding model. And we're really looking at the balance between public funding and private funding and looking how we can have a local, regional, and state shared vision. We work very closely in partnership with Create Wisconsin. And when we have a healthy and flourishing arts and culture sector across the state, that benefits Milwaukee too, and vice versa. So we are leading an effort to bring together these community leaders to address the items in the Curtain Time report. That includes arts leaders, major funders, civic, and getting the right people in the room. And those efforts are going to be underway very soon.
So what do you both see is the first step, or at least what's at top of your mind after your state visit and the efforts that you're doing to fix this disconnect? There's popular opinion that, yes, this benefits everyone, you know, not just mentally, but all these other benefits as well. Yet we need to have that reflected in state funding, in community support, in organizations. How do we bridge that disconnect?
Well, I think it is really being vigilant and educating people. It's a big job. It's ongoing. We've started it. We're not just starting. This is, you know, part of the biennial budget, and this is why it's heightened right now, and we have these things to advocate for, but it's not going to stop whether they get in or they get out. Even if there's more funding for the Arts Board, that's really just a first step because it needs to be much greater to support Wisconsin. And so we're going to continue, and we need people that feel this is important, that love Wisconsin, that love Milwaukee and want to be a part of this community, to understand. And I think they'll be emailing and calling their legislators, and that's what we hope for.
Yeah, it takes relentless messaging. I mean, if it was easy.
I mean, it's your whole job, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, and a forever job. But it's so easy to take arts and culture for granted, to assume our artists and our arts organizations are always going to be here in our community. And we can't make that assumption. So we've all got a job to do. Create those relationships with your legislators. Give them a call. Bring someone to a legislative meeting with you. Because, you know, if enough people demand it and demand it over and over again, we'll realize that change.
You know, I'm thinking the legislative meetings, maybe we can rename them because they don't sound very inviting, you know. Maybe they're like, hey, we care about our community and want to tell you what we care about meetings. So that's really what they are about. They're to listen, learn, talk to people, and share what is important to them.
Well, Christine and Randy, thank you both so much for joining me today to share your experiences and the work that you're continuing to do.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Randy Cohen is the Vice President of Research at Americans for the Arts, and Christine Honacki is the Executive Director of Imagine MKE. Did you know you can listen to Like Effect as a podcast? Search for Like Effect wherever you get your podcast to download and listen on demand. In about 20 minutes, we'll learn about a photo exhibit all about Great Lakes fishing. But first, we'll learn how presidential history is preserved at the White House. That's next on Like Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Like Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The White House Historical Association was founded by First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy in 1961 to help the White House collect and exhibit artifacts of American history and culture. It's a private, nonprofit organization that works to preserve artifacts, pursue research, and provide education. Dr. Matthew Costello is a Wisconsin native who completed his doctorate and master's in American history at Marquette University. His lifelong passion for the subject led him to the White House Historical Association, where he serves as the chief education officer. Costello joins me now to share more about the role and what the job entails. So you grew up in Muskego, went to Pius High School, studied at UW-Madison, and completed your graduate work at Marquette University. Out of all these things, what experiences of your life here in Wisconsin shaped your interest and enthusiasm for studying history?
It's a great question. I think, you know, growing up, I remember the field trips to Old World, Wisconsin, you know, bringing your lunch in the pail. And another thing that I did at one point one summer, I worked in the Sissel Shoe Shop. I worked in the general store. So I quite literally, you know, I played the part. So to speak, at Old World Wisconsin itself, but I've just always been really interested in history. And my parents, my dad especially, very interested in history, World War II, and so that was something that, you know, if he was watching something on TV, I might sit down and watch as well, and it just kind of became one of those things that I think it was part of the environment, part of, you know, my parents saying that that was important, but then also, you know, we had opportunities to go visit historic sites, visit museums, come out east to Washington, D.C., go to Mount Vernon, go to Monticello. So, you know, I got bit by the history bug early, and it's never really gone away.
Speaking of Mount Vernon, one topic of history you're particularly passionate about is George Washington, but your dissertation at Marquette focused on something that people may not expect. It wasn't about his accomplishments while he was alive, but how people remember him, right? Can you explain that?
I've long been very interested in how we talk about history, how people remember historic figures, historic events, because it's sort of this ongoing dialogue between whatever's happening today in the contemporary and what has happened and how people choose to remember those things. And I think those choices are very critical to understanding sort of their mindsets, their political, their social, their cultural mindsets, and understanding their own relationship to the past. And you know, that is not a uniquely American thing. I mean, that's something that communities, people, you know, states, all different sized groups think about their past and their traditions and these things. And also upon my advisor's recommendation, you know, she had told me, you know, if you're going to write about George Washington, you're going to have to take a different approach. There's been a lot of books written about George Washington. And so when I told her, the dissertation isn't really about George Washington, it's about how people remembered George Washington, which tells us something entirely different. It wasn't really about Washington's deeds or his accomplishments or his failings, but it was about how people decided to remember those things. And so ultimately that led to the dissertation and then the first book. And needless to say, George and I we've been very close for a long time.
So while George Washington never, you know, stayed in the White House, it wasn't built at that time during his presidency. Can you share a bit about what the White House Historical Association is and the history behind its founding and mission?
Of course. We were founded in 1961 at the request of First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy to enhance the public understanding of the White House and the people who lived there and worked there. And since that time, we've worked with every administration. For many years, we had really more of a role as a fundraiser in raising awareness. You know, the federal government only appropriates money for things like maintenance and upkeep. But if we're talking about things like fine and decorative arts, if we're talking about things like presidential and first lady portraiture, new artwork, state services, I mean, these are things that are generally now paid with by private money. And a lot of it is through the White House Historical Association. And so in addition to acquisition, conservation, and preservation projects, we also have an educational mission. And as the chief education officer and director of the Rubenstein Center, this is really the hub that oversees our teacher training, our field trip program now with the People's House, which is a new visitor experience in Washington, our research and scholarship with our team of historians, our fellows, both academic and research. And then also, we also have a digital library, which has more than 30,000 publicly available images of the White House and various things at the White House. So our big message with the Rubenstein Center has been to encourage new scholarship about the White House, encourage younger professionals who are interested in researching and writing about the White House or the people who live there and work there, but also to make this history more accessible and more readily available for everyone.
The White House is also a unique national, it's not quite a national monument, it's like a living monument, right? Because there are presidents that occupy it, there's staff, there's events, a whole range of things. And this is much different compared to, say, going to the Jefferson Memorial. So can you share a bit about kind of the fun challenge it is to work for a place that has so much history, but still constantly needs to evolve?
Yeah, that's a great point. The White House really is, it's a, you know, home, office, stage, museum, but all at the same time, an event space. And, you know, that's what it is used for a lot of the time, between the public tours, between bill signings, press conferences, state visits. You know, the White House is constantly being transformed and turned over for the next event or the next event, or the next event. And so, you know, even though we are the private partner, so we're not directly involved with those types of things, but, you know, we're supportive of the White House and the executive residence staff that is tasked with doing a lot of those things. And that staff, it really is sort of the continuity of the house, because as you mentioned, presidents and first ladies and first families come and go, but the executive residence staff really stays there. Many of them stay there for years, some even stay for decades, and they really are the continuity of the institution of the White House. And so you go to Mount Vernon and you'll talk to the interpreters and they tell you that the house is essentially set in 1799 when George Washington died. So then it's just sort of like, okay, that's it. That's the end point, 1799. Everything you're looking at, 1799. But you can't really do that with the White House, because every day a new page of that history is being written. And so for us, I think the most challenging part has been, you know, we are a historic organization. We are an educational organization. So how do we balance serving that role and giving people context, giving people nuance, but also, you know, staying clear of whatever is happening in the contemporary, right? So we generally don't talk about policy or politics of any administration that's in office, but, you know, after they leave and they become a historic example, you know, then it's something that we do. It does kind of then fall more into our mission.
Yeah. Can you share a little more detail about how these things shape what your day-to-day looks like? When we were first getting in touch, obviously the funeral of President Carter was happening, and then the upcoming inauguration, and those things kind of impact, okay, what are people asking us to research or explain? So yeah, can you just share some insights about what it looks like? And, you know, do you have the flexibility to choose what you're researching or working on, or is that dependent on the requests that come through?
I would say it's a little bit of both. We have some of our own projects that are ongoing that we've been working on. And then, you know, as you mentioned, there are times where things happen, there are historic occasions and moments that happen, and then we need to sort of, you know, pivot and quickly be able to talk about those things. And it can be challenging because, you know, all of a sudden I've become an expert in White House Easter egg rolls. I've become an expert in Christmas decorations. That's not something I ever would have imagined that I would be doing in grad school. But, you know, I see it as it's part of the job. And when there's interest in the White House or things that are happening at the White House, people want to know the history behind those things. And so a lot of these seasonal and holiday things we can plan and we can anticipate. But then when we get notice that there's going to be a state arrival, there's going to be a state dinner, well, then we need to sort of pivot and be ready, because typically people want to know, has this country ever visited, or has this leader ever visited, and when was the last time they visited, and what, you know, they start asking those questions. And so I see it as our role to be the authoritative source for answering those type of things. And so sometimes it can be something like, you know, when was the last canceled egg roll, which was something that came up during the pandemic. Or it can be, you know, oh, when was the last time the president of France visited? So, you know, it can be very dependent upon sort of the current events and what's happening and how can we add a little bit of historic context to what people are seeing. But then it can also be, and I would say most of the time, you know, we're spending our time working on our own research projects, articles, resources.
Well, and having both of those aspects to juggle, what do you think are the pros and cons of being a historical generalist, you know, in the work that you do?
Well, you know, I think that the pro obviously is that you probably have at least one insightful thing to say about everything. but then the downside of that is there are certain topics that you obviously feel more comfortable talking about or you can go deeper. And then there are other topics that you probably do just have to give a very basic explanation because either you haven't had time to go deeper or you haven't read up or researched more on a particular topic. And so that does happen. And when it does happen, I think you just have to be quite honest. And you know, you say the words that everyone dreads saying, you know, I don't know. that's something that I'd have to look into and I'd have to, you know, do a little bit more research. And, you know, typically when that kind of stuff happens, I mean, I feel like it's a much better policy to just say, you know, I don't know. I could look into that and I could send you whatever I find. And so you just kind of have to be honest with whoever you're talking to that you may not have all the answers. And I think there's a big misconception about people just assume because it's the White House that everything has always been minutely documented about absolutely everything that's ever happened in the White House. That is not the case. You know, in fact, you know, what we think of today is how the presidency is minutely documented minute by minute. That's really more like a post-World War II type development. And so, you know, if you're talking about anything from White House history before 1945, the documentation and evidence really varies depending on the era, depending on the people, depending on the staff. And so I think a lot of people are surprised when if I say like, I don't know, or I can't find an answer. But when in fact, you know, there's still a lot that we don't know about the White House. And that's a big part of the push that we're making in trying to encourage young professionals, emerging scholars, to do more work that can help us teach more about the White House and teach more Americans about the White House.
When you come across those situations of, hold on, we need to look into that more, what's a question that either came in recently or in your tenure that stuck out to you, you know, whether you could find the answer or not, something that was intriguing and kind of sent you on a fact hunt, so to speak?
Well, just very recently, we had a question come into our research inbox, and sometimes we do get these questions. It is, you know, an individual who is looking for more evidence about a family story or a family legend or a family tradition. And this particular person was curious about, I think it was a third great grandfather, and they had always heard sort of, you know, through their family that this person worked at the White House as a gardener. And then they had also heard that he was involved in building Abraham Lincoln's catafalque. Catafalque is the raised platform that they put the casket on when they have the lion in state ceremony at the Capitol Rotunda. They built one after Lincoln was assassinated. They also built one for the White House because that was where Lincoln had his funeral service. And so, you know, I corresponded with this person. I checked sort of all the different places I knew to check. I was able to at least find the official register. They print all the names of government employees, you know, throughout the 19th century. And they tell you the department they report to and their salary, where they were born, et cetera, et cetera. And so I was able to find her descendant's name, but I was just kind of like, I think based on this, it's certainly plausible that, you know, your descendant worked on the grounds because they were listed as a laborer for the public grounds and works. But I also pointed out because they weren't designated as White House, they probably moved around a lot, right? They may have been a gardener at the White House, but they probably also did work in other places in DC because it was all of the public buildings. And so, you know, having those kind of opportunities where I can try to use sort of my research, you know, muscles and acumen to try to help people find out a little bit more detail about a family member or, you know, to try to figure out if a story that they've always heard has any legitimacy or authenticity to it. those are the types of inquiries I think are really interesting because you really kind of go into a deep dive with somebody else, and it's a very personal story for them too.
Absolutely. And it touches upon this theme of legacy that you've been drawn to, that you've studied. So, from that dissertation at Marquette to the work you're doing now, how has your thoughts on the concept of legacy either been reaffirmed or changed?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think one of the things that I always grappled with Washington was this idea of how does the individual that we're talking about shape legacy, even if they're not there? And I think the initial explanation is, well, they're not there, so they're not shaping legacy. But what I found is, even though Washington may not be there, or really you could take anyone, you could take Jimmy Carter as an example. He's not there, but how is he shaping how we remember him? And it's through things like state funerals. It's through things like their family members, their supporters. And so this idea that presidents or, important American historical figures can shape their legacy even beyond, the time that they leave this life. I mean, that's a very real thing. And, to see that play out, not only with how I studied it with George Washington, but then most recently to see it with President Jimmy Carter, I think it just sort of reaffirms that the figures themselves are active participants in that legacy-making process.
Well, Matthew, I want to thank you so much for joining me today to share not only your job, but your passion. I really enjoyed learning more.
Yeah, it was a pleasure, and I'm glad I could be on. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Matthew Costello is the Chief Education Officer for the White House Historical Association. We spoke earlier this year.
Bublu Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm WUWM's Excaret Nunez. Every day, thousands of people visit the Milwaukee County Zoo to see the animals they love. Whether it's the adorable otters, roaring tigers, or giant elephants, these animals live their lives on display. But most of us don't know what happens after they die. That prompted Bubbler Talk listener Terry Puick Sandberg to ask,
what happens to the bodies of the animals that die at the Milwaukee County Zoo?
To find out, I took a trip to the zoo to meet Tim Wild, the zoo's large mammal curator.
Well, the first thing we do is we call the vet staff. They come down, they confirm everything that we know. And
he says every animal that meets its end at the zoo is required to get a necropsy. Necropsy is just a fancy word for animal autopsy. And the smallest to biggest creatures you can think of get one, from starfish to giraffes. They're transported to the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine.
This is our necropsy facility. As you can hear with the echo, it's cavernous, like a gymnasium.
That's David Gasper. He's a veterinary anatomic pathologist who performs necropsies on zoo animals from across Wisconsin. He searches for clues about the animal's health, a sort of disease detective.
So we do a complete external physical exam, just like your veterinarian would when you bring your dog in. Head to tail, so everything gets measured and described, and then we'll do an internal examination.
Next, they preserve parts of the animals on slides to get a closer look.
We try to match up what we found, and every one of those changes, whether it's normal or abnormal, it could be an age-related change, or it could be a tumor, or it could be an abscess. All of those things we look at under the microscope. This giant microscope sitting next to us is where I spend three or four times as much time as I do doing the necropsies.
Gasper says what veterinary pathologists find can be used to improve the care of living animals both in the zoo and in the wild. After the necropsy is done, Gasper says there are four different ways an animal's remains can be disposed of. There's cremation, burial on zoo grounds, composting, and something called alkaline digestion. A quick warning that this next part is a bit graphic.
Alkaline digestion is a process where we put the remains into a lye solution under high pressure, and it dissolves pretty much everything except the bones, and the bones at the end of the day are basically dust. Essentially a giant instant pot with lye.
Gasper says the digester is used in particular to destroy things like an elephant's ivory tusks or a tiger's teeth, which poachers might try to find. The Milwaukee County Zoo also doesn't publicly disclose burial sites to prevent poaching. The zoo doesn't hold memorial services for the animals, but Gasper says they're still mourned. He says he creates keepsakes for zookeepers by taking paw or hoof prints of nearly every animal that comes for a necropsy.
The human-animal bond is something that it deeply affects everyone. They're taken care of in the same capacity with the same concern as I would my dog or my cat. And so these are important things to give back.
Tim Wild with the Milwaukee County Zoo says an animal's remains continue educating people.
The UW Zoological Museum takes a lot of the skeletons for their collection for educational reasons there. We might bring horns or antlers or part of the hides back. There's a lot of samples that might go to researchers throughout the country. So there's lots of different ways that that animal can continue to help educate not just us, but people all over.
Bubbler Talk listener Terry Puick-Sandberg says she's surprised to learn about all the work that happens after an animal dies at the zoo.
I got far more information than I ever thought was going to be possible. Like I said, I thought it was just, I put them on a truck and off they go somewhere. I had no idea there were all those different ways. I had no idea about the necropsy. No concept.
So the next time you go to the zoo, take a moment to appreciate not just the living animals in front of you, but all that happens behind the scenes when they're gone.
What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit WUWM.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
After one more break, we'll tell you how you can learn where the fish you eat comes from through a series of photographs at the Maritime Museum. That's next on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Have you ever sat down for a Friday fish fry and wondered where that fried fish in a basket came from? A new exhibit at the Maritime Museum in Manitowoc helps people understand where the fish we eat comes from. It's called From Lake to Plate, and it tells the story of Wisconsin's fishermen, smokehouses, and even the delivery drivers. The story is captured through 50 years of photographs taken by Tom Kuchera and Jim LaGault. They join WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz at the exhibit.
So really from the beginning, when I started, you know, having these meetings and discussions with Joe here, I love the photos, I love the portraits. I could see why this was such a great story. It was a very good Milwaukee story. But here at the Wisconsin Maritime Museum, we cast a wider net, right? We have a broader storytelling scope. So I challenged Joe actually a little bit, if you remember, and let's see if we can marry the present fishing industry to the 1950s, 60s, when you really your family, your photos were taken, your dad's photos. So that's kind of how we began then interacting with Jim Legault, this other photographer who's still alive and practicing photography, a variety of different kinds. And these photographs are part of our collection that he's donated over the years, but they go back to the 1970s, and really it is the workers on these fishing tugs and out on the water. And so the process is, as you can see, from lake to plate, through the catch, into the processing, And then all the way kind of to behind the scenes in the workshop, in the offices of Empire Fish, and then finishing with the plate. You know, we both wanted to make sure that we kind of frame the history of Empire Fish and Milwaukee's story, but also bring it to the present in the contemporary sense. And by doing that, saying that the industry has gone through ups and downs, and it still will, ebbs and flows, peaks and waves even, and a lot of that has to do with ecology. So, you know, telling that story, but also realizing that this is an enduring tradition and we want to see it celebrated and endure for generations to come. So at the very end, you have a way to pick up some literature, Wisconsin fish markets with addresses and those QR codes and takeaways for people to like go and support these industries that you can find local caught perch or local caught whitefish and even coho salmon that are out on the lake. So
what's the story of this beautiful model?
These are from our collection. We have so many models in the collection, and even early on, Joe, we were saying we don't want to make this about fish tugs and just like props and stuff.
It's about
the people. But I think it's important to frame it with these are the vessels that we identify with, even on the horizon historically. You know, there's not many left. So the first one is a cutaway, and this shows what it's like on the inside of one of these fish tugs. And this one is the Eagle model, and it's from the 1950s. And so with that, it's paired with the photography. Then you see, you know, even how they haul in the nets. And again, it kind of frames the scale, but also the technology. And again, it comes then down to the people. So each of these images has a human in it, typically, and that's the real thing.
Does this take us from down south along the lake to Door County, for example, or where does this journey take us?
It is kind of interspersed, as you can see. We didn't want to necessarily say, okay, just Milwaukee, but we did start a little bit with Port Washington here, because it does end even in Milwaukee over here on this side. So it was not necessarily geographically laid out, but really more in process and in time, temporally. So you see, I mean, really 1970s here to the present. So Jim took these over 50 years ago, almost 50 years ago, and then here, you know, even just in the last couple of years. And the families are still here, the Hickey brothers. So here's Dennis Hickey is here because he's blonde hair. And then as you get over here, you actually see him in the warehouse in the processing many years later.
That's the idea behind the fishing families connected to the foodways. Looking at the multi-generational businesses and understanding their connection to the lake and how they're bringing us the food that we eat.
Absolutely.
Which is why we begin the exhibit with the question, who are the people that bring us the food that we eat? And then to look at some of these small businesses that, you know, we are encouraging visitors to support, as shown on this map here. In working with Shelby Miller as a part of the project with El Verno College, we collected a lot of the oral histories. We supplemented that with some additional, you know, quotes and stories and, you know, my dad's photos of Empire Fish Company, Jim Legault's photos of his, you know, decades of capturing the family fish companies and fishermen.
You know, we're also trying to tell the story, it's now an international demand. So fish are coming from Canada and Europe and beyond, Scandinavia. And what we're trying to also show is that you can find local catch right here from Lake Michigan, from the Bay of Green Bay. Sourcing those is, I guess, what we're hoping to do is just point some people in the right direction.
Yeah. Dovetailing with an initiative that really is sort of Great Lakes wide and trying to make the most of every fish that's harvested and
right.
Its use goes as far as it can, from consumption to other use.
Yeah, and on that, the perfect projects. Example of Dan Schwartz, who's actually relative of Schwartz Fish in Sheboygan, becoming an importer of fish from the Baltic states and then making gefilte fish using all the parts, exactly like you're
there
saying.
You
so
go.
There's the example of what you're just saying, that
like dog treats, natural fish product. So yeah, state-of-the-art facilities in Sturgeon Bay, and, you know, it's the evolution of this industry, right? From this model, kind of again, this is a diorama showing a 1950s kind of nostalgic view of how fishing was done historically, you know, and these buildings are still around. It's still part of our kind of cultural landscape. But the practice is changing, certainly, with how these fish are harvested, the quotas in which they have to work with. And of course, we still have recreational fishing and, you know, sport fishing, and that is part of the give and take of how much fish are available. What does the stock look like? Which is always changing. But my son is currently right outside fishing in the Manitowoc River. So, you know, it shows that...
What's he fishing for?
Whatever was in there. I don't know. You know, every time we travel, he's just the... You know, that's the thing. It's just, I think, innately interesting to a lot of us. It's a challenge, right, to try to pull something magnificent out of the water. And we did in Port Washington over the Christmas break. He caught a 27-inch trout, brown wow. trout, which we filleted, and he helped and did the processing, and we fried it up and even got some roe out of it. And it was an amazing experience to see it from lake to plate within a day. And,
wow.
And I guess that's the kind wow. of... parting that to the next generation. He's 12. But that, you know, inspires him to keep going out and looking for another fish. What these families have been doing in for generations is that, I think, that livelihood. It's also that challenge and that interest and the inspiration to keep doing it when it is very difficult work.
So this is my dad, and he incorporated his love of photography into his work at Empire Fish, leaving his camera here, his Leica camera, on his desk, and would, you know, occasionally snap a photo of one of the employees on the job, maybe tell a joke, get them smiling. This is my great-grandfather, Jerry Kuchera, in the original location of Empire Fish on Valete Street. You can see the businesses across the street. You can see the herring and salt cod. Here, these ice bins utilized ice blocks from Lake Michigan. The way that my grandfather explained it to me was that ice would freeze over more often, and that was the refrigeration, the method of refrigeration, was buying it from the ice man and then putting the ice blocks in there and then using that as your refrigeration. You know, in looking back at the photos, what's really fun to see is, and again, the theme of the exhibit is to... So the fishing families that are very involved in the industry, and to see all the people that are bringing us the fish that we eat, you know, behind the scenes, but that create kind of a work family, if you will, that, you know, and to realize, oh, our fish doesn't come from just the big box retailers. These are the people that are handling it and bring our food.
And then, so your dad would have taken all of these, for example, or was it a mixture?
It's a mixture of mm-hmm. photos that my dad took, some historical photos of the company when they getting ready for the new location. These are photos of the fishing vessels from the Wisconsin Marine Historical Society, and this is a painting of me at Empire Fish painted by my friend Zav LaPlay.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So who are these two happy ladies, do you know?
Yeah, Johnson. So Greta Johns and Elaine Johnson, they were owners of the Northern Lights Fish Company. It wasn't just about fishermen, but fisherwomen too, and the workers. So the gender aspect of this, you know, while it was challenging, and they were often not allowed on boats, and even today there's some pushback there. But you know, women in commercial industry, we have a whole panel just about that. So even the photographs, we wanted to reflect that the women behind the scenes are equally working as hard.
For me, this process in creating this exhibit, I've actually learned a tremendous amount. I mean, relating it to what Kevin said, the fish companies in the southern half of the lake, like Ewig's and Smith Brothers have shut down, many have shut down. Empire Fish Market is still a retail market there today. I learned how the industry is actually doing, is really coming back in the northern half of Lake Michigan. So even though the industry has, for the most part, disappeared from the southern half, the story in the northern half is quite different. So for me, that was it's been a tremendous experience to learn about that in putting this together. I like relating it back to your story of the son fishing because, you know, these are families that whose job was to connect the lake to the plate.
Yep.
And, you know, in today's modern society, we're so disconnected,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
But to come and just reflect on who those people are and to kind of bring us closer to the source and think about the businesses that we can patronize and support to bring us closer to the lake.
So does it make you want to jump back in the biz?
It's a tough business. It makes me appreciate it all the more, but I'm thrilled to have worked with Kevin here and the museum staff to make this reality, but I'll go get a fish fry.
Tom Kuchera and Jim LaGault are the photographers behind the exhibit From Lake to Plate, Local Fishing Families and Foodways. It's now showing at the Maritime Museum in Manitowoc, and you can check it out now through October of this year. That's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, and X-Grit Nunez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Rob Larry and Graham Thomas. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. Emily Files helps edit the show. We also heard from Mayon Silver and Taryn Powell from the WUWM News team this week. Jason Reevy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Join us again on Monday at noon to learn how Milwaukee schools are looking to other successful school districts to try and improve education outcomes here. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.